Can you just explain for one moment what you mean about the announcement of the Nobel Peace Prize and what bearing that has on these negotiations?
We've been told repeatedly over the last year that Trump's eyes are on the Nobel Peace Prize because Obama got one, so he was very determined to get one as well because of that in particular. And it was one of his driving forces in decision making, whether it is the trying to get an end to the war in Ukraine or trying to get a ceasefire deal in Gaza. The Nobel Committee is about to announce the winner of the Peace Prize tomorrow around the middle of the day European time. So in Israeli media, they've been very explicit for days that the main reason why Netanyahu could not say no to Trump throughout this last week or even a little bit before from the UN General Assembly is because he didn't want to be seen as the one denying Trump the Nobel Peace Prize. And it's ironic, it's psychedelic and crazy, but it is basically one of the political motivations playing here.
Moin Rabbani, you mentioned earlier the question of the Palestinian prisoners who will be released in exchange for the Israeli hostages who remain in captivity in Gaza. Is there, you said, of course, those names have not been released, but is there any indication that either Marwan Barghouti or the General Secretary of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, Ahmad Sadat, will be among those released?
Thus far, there isn't. So far as I can tell, there's no clarity that they will or will not be released. Clearly, they're at the very top of Hamas's list, and that would also allow it to present itself as acting in the Palestinian national interest rather than only, let's say, its factional interest. But, you know, Israeli media have reported that Israel is required to make very painful concessions in the context of this agreement. That may be an indication their names are on the list, but as yet, there is no confirmation about this one way or the other.
And your response, Moin, to those who say, I mean, you think in the piece that you wrote overnight after the deal was reached, that Hamas has not lost all its leverage by agreeing to release the Israeli hostages. Could you explain why you think that's the case?
Yes. I mean, the idea that retaining the Israeli captives was somehow Hamas's only guarantee for ending the war is not really one I subscribe to. I think the captives serve as leverage only for the purpose of an exchange with Israel and obtaining the freedom of Palestinian captives in Israel's prison system. Apart from that, they have primarily served as a pretext for genocide, and they most certainly haven't served the purpose of defending either Hamas leaders or even a single Palestinian child from this unprecedented genocidal Israeli bombing campaign. And it may in fact be the case that releasing them in the context of an exchange and not having any more Israeli captives in the Gaza Strip could make it more difficult for Israel to resume its genocidal military campaign. But again, you know, this is an agreement. It's not a peace agreement. It's a ceasefire agreement and a partial one. And given Israel's previous conduct, and even more importantly, U.S. indulgence for Israel's conduct, the indulgence of the West as a whole, this is a situation where Israel, should it so choose, and it will so choose, I suspect, will find a method to abrogate this agreement and ensure it is only of a temporary nature.
Mohammed Shahada, your family is from Gaza. You are from Gaza. You're now in Copenhagen. What have you heard from your family on the ground? And also, you've said that this deal was just signed, that was just being agreed on. Is the clearest admission by Israel and the U.S. that they've deliberately been starving Gaza and that Israel's been holding thousands of Gazans hostage without trial or charges? I mean, over time, over the decades, Israel's held more than a million Palestinians detained them. And I think at this point, right, it's the highest number of Palestinians held at any one time in Israeli jails.
Yes, absolutely. Precisely. So you have basically in the written agreement that Trump released, it said explicitly that in return for Hamas releasing the 20 Israeli living captives, that Israel would release 1,700 Palestinian captives that have been taken after October 7th from Gaza, What that means is that those are people that were not in the October 7th attack when it unfolded, that people that were rounded up, basically every area that Israel has, invades in Gaza, they would take people at random, process them with racial profiling. Anyone that they think resembles a sort of a religious person, they would take them, or anyone that is a doctor or a journalist or a nurse or an academic, they would take them to this Data Iman concentration camp, what Israel's own B'Tselem, a human rights organization, referred to as a torture camp, and hold them there as a bargaining chip without visits by the Red Cross, without legal counsel, without charges, without trial. So I have a friend whose brother was taken this way, and he was only allowed to meet with a lawyer one time. And he's been asking the Israelis, why am I here? The same answer they gave him over and over and over again is that you are here until a ceasefire deal is signed and then you will be released. Trump, you heard him saying earlier this year that it only takes a very sick mind for someone to hold a dead body as a hostage. But little did he know that Israel has been holding hundreds of Palestinian dead bodies way before October 7th. One of them is Noura Arakat's cousin, who was murdered by the Israelis at a checkpoint in the West Bank on his way to his sister's wedding, on the day of his sister's wedding. And Israel has been holding his body ever since. You had at least 250 Palestinian dead bodies that Israel was holding as a bargaining chip. And they collected hundreds more of bodies throughout the genocide that they're holding as what they call strategic assets to use as leverage in negotiations. The other thing about the starvation is you had in the deal written explicitly that Israel would allow more aid to go into Gaza, which means that Israel had the capacity, the ability all along to allow way more aid to go into Gaza, but they had the clear will to not allow any of this in. We've seen it in the previous ceasefire. All the problems that Israel keeps citing as the reasons for the famine disappeared. The looting, the gang violence, the chaos, all of it disappeared, and food was coming in 600 trucks per day. Now you, in this agreement, you will have 400 trucks coming through 5 border crossings, and then it will be scaled up to 600. The last thing about family and friends in Gaza, I've been calling people on the ground since the morning. There's the sentiment that of they will believe it only when they see it. And even when they see it, because we've been here before multiple times, Amy, in November 2023 or in January this year, or I personally lived through 10 Israeli military operations, 3 wars and 2 grand invasions. Each of them ended with a ceasefire agreement where Israel would make promises about ending the siege, the draconian siege on Gaza, or at least reducing it. And as soon as a ceasefire deal is signed, nobody bothers with the details. Gaza disappears and it's back to this slow, latent, invisible violence of starvation and encaging people in a permanent state of non-life. It is expected to be the exact same thing. I've been talking to people, they don't feel anything positive about the declaration until they see it materialize, and they know that there is a lot of devils in the details. They know Israel has a vested interest in sabotaging that deal throughout. This morning, Israel even intensified the bombing way more than before. It's like they are in a rush, in a hurry, to kill as many people as possible and destroy much of the urban space as much as possible. They've been detonating those robotic suicide vehicles since yesterday. They've been bombing Khan Yunis, Deir al-Balah, Gaza City, Al-Sabra, Tel el-Hawa, Al-Shati camp. I just saw a footage where Israeli tanks are literally bombing people live on television on the beach, the people that were trying to go back to their homes. One of our colleagues, Mu'tasim Dalul in Gaza, just lost his third son today that was murdered by the IDF. So on the other side, you have people that are so exhausted, that are desperate for any glimmer of hope. I was just talking to a cousin in his late 40s in Gaza City last week, and he looked exactly like my grandfather when he died when he was over 100 years old. He was skin and bone. You can literally see his eyes are sunken. His face is wrinkled and darkened. And those people are desperate for the slightest glimmer of hope. So hopefully they will get some good news soon.
Well, let's bring in Ori Goldberg. We were just sorting out some technical issues. Ori, if you could respond to the deal and tell us how people in Israel are responding. The hostages are expected to be released on Monday. Of course, there will be the living hostages and also the deceased ones.
Well, the only issue that matters to the Israeli Jewish public at large is the fate of the hostages. They absolutely don't care in any way, shape, or form about the suffering or the plight of the Palestinians. And even the fate of the hostages is more a myth than it is a pressing national security issue. Israel has resorted back to discourse that's familiar to every Israeli post-war, and that is mistakes were made, people are to blame, we will find them, we will force them to bear responsibility, and then we will rise from the ashes as we always have, because that is what we do. We will rise, we will make Israel better, we will make it a more robust democracy. We owe it to our children, and so forth, and so forth. But even the issue of the hostages, which is, again, the only reason Israelis have called for an end to the quote-unquote war, is resonating very much in a human interest kind of way, or in a finally this nightmare is over, we can wake up and go back to reality. There are Israelis who, especially religious ones, who celebrate overtly the killing of Palestinians, and they, of course, are disappointed. They wanted a total victory. They wanted Hamas destroyed. But the great majority of Israelis enable the genocide and support the genocide by not talking about the genocide.
You're an Israeli political analyst. You're a scholar based in Tel Aviv. What about Ben-Gvir and Smotrich not supporting the ceasefire, but not pulling out of the government, which would bring it down?
Ben-Gvir and Smotrich are less powerful than they may appear from the outside. They're both sectorial leaders, and there's a real difference between them. Smotrich is an ideologue. He has an ideological movement behind him. The settlers and what is called religious Zionism, which is also the name of his party. Ben-Gvir is an old-fashioned populist here to simply torch the place and cause as much mayhem and death and destruction as he can. Both would be lost without their membership in Netanyahu's government. Both would lack for the executive power they prize so dearly, Smotrich in the West Bank and Ben-Gvir over domestic security in everything from licenses for carrying weapons to not investigating or enforcing Israeli law on crime, which is rampant in Israeli-Palestinian society. They are not leaders meant for the opposition. They are meant for power, and they know it. And they will find excuses. Perhaps Smotrich will leave, but it's more likely that they will explain to their base that it's better that they're on the inside to prevent even worse decisions from being made. But I think perhaps it's more important to talk about Netanyahu himself and why this deal is good for him, not bad for him. Because Netanyahu can now be the complete package. Netanyahu was the fearless leader who fought the difficult, inevitable war. But he is now the fearless leader who brings the difficult, inevitable deal. And he is the grown-up in the room. Smotrich and Ben-Gvir are the adolescents. You know, they do whatever they want. They're juvenile. They have no responsibility. Netanyahu knows what's what, and he was able to bring the hostages back. And should a snap election be called in Israel over the next 6 months, there's a very good chance that it will. That makes Netanyahu perhaps the most favored candidate to win the prime ministership again.
And Ori, if you could respond to what our guests earlier were saying, some understandable skepticism about whether Israel will abide by the agreement, and if so, to what extent?
It is well-founded. If I was a Palestinian, I wouldn't trust an official Israeli farther than I could throw him. But I think we need to take into consideration the fact that certainly over the past 2 months, Israel's international stature and Israel's absolute impunity have taken real hits. Israel is not as strong as it was even 2 months ago. And the notion that Israel always dictates the pace of events, that was the grand prize for which Netanyahu fought. He wanted to demonstrate that Israel can do whatever it wants to whomever it wants, wherever it wants. That is not the case anymore. Despite the reluctance, despite the alliances, the criminal alliances between Israel and global leaders, Israel simply cannot have its way every time. And that in and of itself, I think, is grounds enough to assume that the situation now is different. Add to that the fact that the Israeli public considers itself to have undergone a very difficult 2 years, sees itself as unrightfully victimized by its own government and by every global leader out there. An Israeli public that just wants to get back to normal, which means to repress the fact of the occupation and to return to life as a Jewish and democratic state. effectively an ethnocracy built on Jewish supremacy. Netanyahu knows this. He knows this very well. Netanyahu is not an aberration. He's not an anomaly. He's the quintessential Israeli prime minister. That's why he keeps winning. Not because he's a magician who pulls cards out of his sleeve, because he knows this is what Israelis approve of. And consistent polling shows that he's right. While Israelis may have protested his government, while certain sectors of Israeli society did not see themselves aligned with his ministers, the great majority of Israeli Jews supported his government's policies in Gaza. That is not something that can be wished away. That is still true. His would-be competitors, his would-be heirs from the opposition, have never said anything that differed significantly from the genocidal policies we've seen for the past 2 years in Gaza. Netanyahu knows this, and he is using this, as any savvy politician would, to situate himself for further battles.
So, Ori, you said that this signals basically the end of Israeli impunity on the global stage. Do you think that applies to the U.S. as well?
I do, because I don't think Trump is beholden to Israel even remotely when you consider the way Joe Biden was beholden to Israel. I think the American political map is changing. I think public opinion in the United States is changing. I think it's become very much an almost basic principle that America should not be forced to fund foreign wars, especially foreign wars that turn into genocides. I think Trump is hearing that incessantly from his own base. I think Trump is under pressure from that base, not because of the genocide, but because of the Epstein files and because of his behavior within, you know, American politics, because of the government shutdown. I think all of these political interests are converging. And that is why I am, you know, cautiously optimistic about the potential of this deal, because this isn't about the Palestinians. None of the major players here care about the Palestinians, except for the people who represent the Palestinians. None of them care about the Palestinians. Everybody has something to gain from this deal. It has to do with their political future, their political survival. And at this time, after 2 years, when the world ignored the Israeli genocide, perhaps the only thing that can start a process in motion is when the stars align and political interests converge.
Finally, Uri, if you can talk about the significance of apparently President Trump going to Israel, Netanyahu inviting him to address the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, as early as Sunday.
Well, that is political pageantry. We're used to it in Israel, having an American president address the Knesset usually is something that goes with the signing of a peace treaty. We have to keep in mind, of course, obviously, as your other guests have said, that this is not a peace treaty. There's no peace after a genocide. This perhaps signals the end of the beginning. It's a ceasefire. It is a cessation of death, and hopefully a cessation of a massacre. And the fact that Trump claims this as his privilege, perhaps that will be a consolation prize when he's not awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo.
Ori Goldberg, I want to thank you for being with us, Israeli political analyst and scholar outside Tel Aviv and Herzliya. We also want to thank Mohammed Shahada, a writer and analyst from Gaza, visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. And finally, Muin Rabbani, Middle East analyst, co-editor of Jadliya, a non-resident fellow at the Center for Conflict and Humanitarian Studies. Coming up, we go to Paris, where one of the hundreds of global Samud flotilla activists who were abducted by Israel on the high seas and detained is now. We'll speak with Progressive International's David Adler and hear comments from Mandla Mandela, the former South African MP and grandson of Nelson Mandela, both just released. is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Israeli forces intercepted another Gaza-bound humanitarian aid flotilla in the early hours of Wednesday morning that was attempting to break Israel's blockade and deliver humanitarian aid. The Freedom Flotilla Coalition and 1,000 Madleens to Gaza sent a fleet of 11 vessels with 150 people on board, including doctors. They initially said three boats were attacked in international waters, 120 nautical miles off the coast of Gaza. Soon after, all boats were intercepted by Israel. This was the second such interception in the past week. Days before, Israeli forces intercepted about 40 vessels and detained more than 450 activists who were part of the global Sumud flotilla. Some of the activists abducted on the high seas reported physical abuse, humiliation, and inhumane treatment by Israeli soldiers. Detained activists aboard the global Sumud flotilla included the former South African Prime Minister Mandla Member of Parliament, Mandla Mandela, the grandson of Nelson Mandela. He was held in an Israeli prison for 6 days before being released via Jordan.
We were handcuffed with cable ties, tied tightly behind our backs, taken off our boats, and put on the platform, paraded for all the Israelis and the allies in Europe and the West and the global community to see. But it's nothing compared to what Palestinians have been subjected to on a daily basis. We were kidnapped on international waters. Palestinians are attacked, maimed, and killed, whilst many of our comrades were offered opportunity to shower. They ensured that the South African delegation was denied this. But we understood very well why that is so. Because we are a nation that dared through our government to take apartheid Israel to the International Court of Justice.
That was Mandla Mandela, the grandson of Nelson Mandela, after he was released from an Israeli jail, part of the Sumud flotilla, now back in South Africa. We're joined in Paris by David Adler, co-general coordinator of Progressive International, who participated in the Gaza-bound global Sumud flotilla before it was intercepted by Israeli forces. He's written a new piece for Jacobin, headlined, "I spent 5 days in Israel's desert prison." Welcome back to Democracy Now!, David. We spoke to you on the high seas. Tell us what happened to you and what happened to the other flotilla activists before you were deported.
So last Wednesday night, in the early hours of the morning, we were violently raided and abducted by Israeli naval forces in international waters. And over the coming hours, as was said by my comrade Mandla Mandela, we were taken to the port of Ashdod, where our belongings and boats were stolen from us and confiscated. They literally ripped jewelry, necklaces, rings, precious things out of our bags and belongings and threw them away or confiscated them without any access to them from demand that we could make on our own. And we were, you know, put in positions of humiliation and paraded around for Ben Gvir and his friends to take a photo opportunity. At that point, they reached down and saw my passport, which had my full name, David Rashi Kremen Adler, and asked if I was Jewish. I said I was Jewish. They ripped me by the ear and forced me to bend down and stare at the flag of the State of Israel for Ben Gvir to come and have a personal one-on-one and call me a terrorist to my face. Over the coming hours, we were strip-searched, zip-tied, blindfolded, and disappeared into the Negev Desert, into one of the most infamous Guantanamo Bay of Israel, Ketziot detention camps, 400,000 square meters, where many hundreds and thousands of political prisoners from Palestine have been held and tortured over the course of the past 30 years, since and indeed since it was reopened in 2002 after they had to shut it down for repeated reports of serial human rights violations. Over the coming days inside that camp, we as internees, I should say, it wasn't a prison, it was an internment camp, suffered serial and systematic violations of our most basic rights. We had on and off no access to food, water, never a shower. The North Africans in particular were targeted for severe abuse and beatings, taken out of their cells with German shepherds and guns at their heads, and cuffed at the hands, cuffed at the ankles, blindfolded and put into isolation. We had to sort of try to rally as a cell block to get them back. And I must say, systematic deprivation of life-saving medicine, which includes insulin. One of the women in the cell blocks had such a severe kidney infection that she fainted twice and over 2 days was denied access to medicine. And these were just the most basic basic conditions that we endured over the course of our time in Ketziot, while we had no access to legal representation, while our families were left without any information about our whereabouts, about our health and existence, and needless to say, without any access or support from U.S. consular services.
Well, indeed, as far as the U.S. response has gone, the Trump administration's response earlier this week, on Monday, U.S. Ambassador to Israel Mike Huckabee took to social media to attack you, David Adler, personally, as a, quote, self-absorbed tool of Hamas. Your response?
My response is that we must break the myth that has been installed in so much of Hollywood propaganda. The United States State Department is out here to save, extract, and rescue you from wherever you are in the world. In fact, if you look at actually the different delegations that are part of this mission, the U.S. delegation was treated by far one of the worst by our own consular services. They did not arrive to the prison camp until maybe 4 days after our disappearance and detention in the middle of the Negev Desert. And when they did, they said, you know what, guys, you're on your own. There's nothing we can do for you. You're in Israel's hands now. And I will say, it did not stop there, the systematic abandonment by the State Department and the consular services. When we were eventually freed and deported to Jordan, we were dropped there. The other delegations that were there were greeted, welcomed, treated, hugged, put into hotels, given flights home. The U.S. consul told us, we are not your babysitters. We will not provide food, water, clothes, hotels, transportation. The most we can do for you is have the Jordanians drive to the airport. We're going to drop you off without any cell phones or money. You are on your own. That is how our government thinks about us. They do not serve us. They serve the state of Israel, and they share what I would maybe describe as the Pete Hegseth school of international law, that due process is no process, and it doesn't matter that we never saw a judge, a jury, never saw our lawyers or a prosecutor, we're never charged with anything. This is just a fraction of what we know Palestinians who are still in these torture and detention camps, 11,000 of whom were taken from Gaza alone, let alone the West Bank, are suffering on a daily basis. This is what happens to, you know, white Westerners, in my case, a Jewish American, humanitarian workers who are simply trying to deliver basic critical aid to the starving people of Palestine.
David Adler, we want to thank you very much for being with us, co-general coordinator of Progressive International, who participated in the Gaza-bound Global Samud flotilla before it was intercepted by Israeli forces. We'll link to your article, I Spent 5 Days in Israel's Desert Prison. That does it for our show. I'll be speaking in Santa Fe, New Mexico on October 17th after the showing of the film about Democracy Now!, Steal This Story, Please. That's at the Lensic Theater, October 17th. On October 18th and 19th, the film will show at the Woodstock Film Festival. And I'll be speaking along with the Oscar-nominated filmmakers of Steal This Story, Please, Tia Lesson and Carl Diehl, and Karen Renucci, the producer. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. You can check our website at democracynow.org.